Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks' The Learning College. Today we're going to do Did 6 Million Really Die? By Richard E. Harwood. And this is from the 20th century. It's about 10 long pages, a small book, if you want to call it, put out by the Institute for Historical Review, IHR. And it questioned some of the main props of the largest anti-white myth ever created. Proves, in fact, that it is a myth. Let's get to it. Did 6 Million Really Die? By Richard E. Harwood. Introduction. Of course, atrocity propaganda is nothing new. It has accompanied every conflict of the 20th century, and doubtless will continue to do so. During the First World War, the Germans were actually accused of eating Belgian babies, as well as delighting to throw them in the air and transfix them on bayonets. The British also alleged that the German forces were operating a, quote, corpse factory, in which they boiled down the bodies of their own dead in order to obtain glycerin and other commodities, a calculated insult to the honor of an imperial army. After the war, however, came the retractions. Indeed, a public statement was made by the Foreign Secretary in the House of Commons apologizing for the insults to German honor, which were admitted to be wartime propaganda. No such statements have been made after the Second World War. In fact, rather than diminish with the passage of years, the atrocity propaganda concerning the German occupation, and in particular their treatment of the Jews, has done nothing but increase its virulence and elaborate its catalog of horrors. Gruesome paperback books with lurid covers continue to roll from the presses, adding continuously to a growing mythology of the concentration camps, and especially to the story that no less than 6 million Jews, capital letters, were exterminated in them. The ensuing pages will reveal this claim to be the most colossal piece of fiction and the most successful of deceptions, but here an attempt may be made to answer an important question. What has rendered the atrocity stories of the Second World War so uniquely different from those of the First? Why were the latter retracted, while the former are reiterated louder than ever? Is it possible that the story of the 6 million Jews is serving a political purpose, even that it is a form of political blackmail? So far as the Jewish people themselves are concerned, the deception has been an incalculable benefit. Every conceivable race and nationality had its share of suffering in the Second World War, but none has so successfully elaborated it and turned it to such great advantage. The alleged extent of their persecution quickly aroused sympathy for the Jewish national homeland they had sought for so long. After the war, the British government did little to prevent Jewish emigration to Palestine, which they had declared illegal, and it was not long afterwards that the Zionists wrested from the government the land of Palestine and created their haven from persecution, the State of Israel. Indeed, it is a remarkable fact that the Jewish people emerged from the Second World War as nothing less than a triumphant minority. Dr. Max Nussbaum, the former chief rabbi of the Jewish community in Berlin, stated on April 11, 1953, "The position the Jewish people occupy today in the world, despite the enormous losses, is 10 times stronger than what it was 20 years ago." He said that in 1953. It should be added, if one is to be honest, that this strength has been much consolidated financially by the supposed massacre of the 6 million, undoubtedly the most profitable atrocity allegation of all time. To date, the staggering figure of £6,000,000,000 has been paid out in compensation by the federal government of West Germany, mostly to the State of Israel, which did not even exist during the Second World War, as well as to individual Jewish claimants. And of course, it's a multiple of what he was talking about when he wrote this. That's the end of the introduction. Next section, discouragement of nationalism. In terms of political blackmail, however, the allegation that 6 million Jews died during the Second World War has much more far-reaching implications for the people of Britain and Europe than simply the advantages it has gained for the Jewish nation. And here one comes to the crux of the question. Why the big lie? What is its purpose? In the first place, it has been used quite unscrupulously to discourage any form of nationalism. Should the people of Britain or any other European country attempt to assert their patriotism and preserve their national integrity in an age when the very existence of nation-states is threatened, they are immediately branded as neo-Nazis. Because, of course, Nazism was nationalism, and we all know what happened then. 6 million Jews were exterminated. So long as the myth is perpetuated, peoples everywhere will remain in bondage to it. The need for international tolerance and understanding will be hammered home by the United Nations until nationhood itself, the very guarantee of freedom, is abolished. A classic use of the 6 million as an anti-national weapon appears in Manvel and Frankel's book, The Incomparable Crime, London, 1967, which deals with genocide in the 20th century. Again, Manvel, M-A-N-V-E-L-L, and Frankel, F-R-A-N-K-L, Manvel and Frankel's book, The Incomparable Crime, which deals with genocide in the 20th century. Anyone with a pride in being British will be somewhat surprised by the vicious attack made on the British Empire in this book. The authors quote Pandit Nehru, who wrote the following while in a British prison in India. Quote, "Since Hitler emerged from obscurity and became the Führer of Germany, we have heard a great deal about racialism and the Nazi theory of the Herrenfolk. But we in India have known racialism in all its forms ever since the commencement of British rule. The whole ideology of this rule was that of the Herrenfolk and the master race. India as a nation and Indians as individuals were subjected to insult, humiliation, and contemptuous treatment. The English were an imperial race, we were told, with the God-given right to govern us and keep us in subjection. If we protested, we were reminded of the tiger qualities of an imperial race." The authors Manvel and Frankel then go on to make the point perfectly clear for us. Quote, "The white races of Europe and America," they write, have become used during centuries to regarding themselves as a Herrenfolk. The 20th century, the century of Auschwitz, has also achieved the first stage in the recognition of multiracial partnership. So that's the kind of thing. First they would say, let's go from whites dominant to multicultural to whites subordinate under white privilege, etc., etc. The race problem suppressed is the next section. One could scarcely miss the object of this diatribe with its insidious hint about multiracial partnership, direct quote. Thus, the accusation of the 6 million is not only used to undermine the principle of nationhood and national pride, but it threatens the survival of the race itself. It is wielded over the heads of the populace rather as the threat of hellfire and damnation was in the Middle Ages. Many countries of the Anglo-Saxon world, notably Britain and America, are today facing the gravest danger in their history, the danger posed by the alien races in their midst. Unless something is done in Britain to halt the immigration and assimilation of Africans and Asians into our country, we are faced in the near future, quite apart from the bloodshed of racial conflict, with the biological alteration and destruction of the British people as they have existed here since the coming of the Saxons. In short, we are threatened with the irrecoverable loss of our European culture and racial heritage. But what happens if a man dares to speak of the race problem, of its biological and political implications? He is branded as that most heinous of creatures, a racialist. And what is racialism? Of course, but the very hallmark of the Nazi. They, so everyone is told anyway, murdered 6 million Jews because of racialism, so it must be a very evil thing indeed. When Enoch Powell drew attention to the dangers posed by colored immigration into Britain in one of his early speeches, a certain prominent socialist raised the specter of Dachau and Auschwitz to silence his presumption. Thus, any rational discussion of the problems of race and the effort to preserve racial integrity is effectively discouraged. No one could have anything but admiration for the way in which Jews have sought to preserve their race through so many centuries, and continue to do so today. In this effort, they have frankly been assisted by the story of the 6 million, which, almost like a religious myth, has stressed the need for greater Jewish racial solidarity. Unfortunately, it has worked in quite the opposite way for all other peoples, rendering them impotent in the struggle for self-preservation. The aim in the following pages is quite simply to tell the truth. The distinguished American historian Harry Elmer Barnes once wrote that, quote, "An attempt to make a competent, objective, and truthful investigation of the extermination question is surely the most precarious venture that an historian or demographer could undertake today." Close quote. In attempting this precarious task, it is hoped to make some contribution not only to historical truth, but towards the lifting of the burden of a lie from our own shoulders so that we may freely confront the dangers which threaten us all. Richard E. Harwood. And then what follows are a list of numbered items that will be explored at length, and that will comprise the book. 1. German policy toward the Jews prior to the war. Rightly or wrongly, the Germany of Adolf Hitler considered the Jews to be a disloyal and avaricious element within the national community, as well as a force of decadence in Germany's cultural life. This was held to be particularly unhealthy since, during the Weimar period, the Jews had risen to a position of remarkable strength and influence in the nation, particularly in law, finance, and the mass media, even though they constituted only 5% of the population. The fact that Karl Marx was a Jew, and that Jews such as Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht were disproportionately prominent in the leadership of revolutionary movements in Germany, also tended to convince the Nazis of the powerful internationalist and communist tendencies of the Jewish people themselves. It is no part of the discussion here to argue whether the German attitude to the Jews was right or not, or to judge whether its legislative measures against them were just or unjust. Our concern is simply with the fact that, believing of the Jews as they did, the Nazis' solution of the problem was to deprive them of their influence within the nation by various legislative acts, and, most of all, to encourage their emigration from the country altogether. By 1939, the great majority of German Jews had emigrated. The great majority of German Jews had emigrated by 1939, before the Second World War started. Never at any time had the Nazi leadership even contemplated a policy of genocide towards them. Jews called emigration extermination. It is very significant, however, that certain Jews were quick to interpret these policies of internal discrimination as equivalent to extermination itself. A 1936 anti-German propaganda book by Leon Feuchtwanger and others entitled Der gelbe Fleck, die Ausrottung von 500.000 Deutschen Juden, The Yellow Spot, The Extermination of 500,000 German Jews, Paris, 1936, presents a typical example by Leon Feuchtwanger. Despite its baselessness in fact, the annihilation of the Jews is discussed from the first pages. Straightforward emigration being regarded as the physical, quote, extermination of German Jewry. The Nazi concentration camps for political prisoners are also seen as potential instruments of genocide, and special references made to the 100 Jews still detained in Dachau in 1936, of whom 60 had been there since 1933. A further example was the sensational book by the German Jewish communist Hans Beimler, called 4 Weeks in the Hands of Hitler's Hellhounds, The Nazi Murder Camp of Dachau, which was published in New York as early as 1933. Detained for his Marxist affiliations, he claimed that Dachau was a death camp, though by his own admission he was released after only a month there. the present regime in East Germany now issues a Hans Beimler Award for services to communism. So you can tell this was written before 1989. I believe it was written in the 70s. The fact that anti-Nazi genocide propaganda was being disseminated at this impossibly early date, therefore, by people biased on racial or political grounds, should suggest extreme caution to the independent-minded observer when approaching similar stories of the war period. So they're writing about Jews being exterminated before the wars even started, when the fact is that the vast majority of Jews emigrated before the war ever began. The encouragement of Jewish emigration should not be confused with the purpose of concentration camps in pre-war Germany. These were used for the detention of political opponents and subversives, principally liberals, social democrats, and communists of all kinds, of whom a proportion were Jews, such as Hans Beimler. Unlike the millions enslaved in the Soviet Union, the German concentration camp population was always small. Reitinger admits that between 1934 and 1938, it seldom exceeded 20,000 throughout the whole of Germany, and the number of Jews was never more than 3,000. In parentheses, the SS, Alibi of a Nation, London, 1956, page 253. So the camp system in Germany was much smaller than the Gulag Archipelago, so-called. Next section, Zionist policy studied. The Nazi view of Jewish emigration was not limited to a negative policy of simple expulsion, but was formulated along the lines of modern Zionism. The founder of political Zionism in the 19th century, Theodor Herzl, in his work, The Jewish State, had originally conceived of Madagascar as a national homeland for the Jews, it's the island off Africa, and this possibility was seriously studied by the Nazis. It had been a main plank of the National Socialist Party platform before 1933 and was published by the party in pamphlet form. This stated that the revival of Israel as a Jewish state was much less acceptable since it would result in a perpetual war and disruption in the Arab world, which has indeed been the case. The Germans were not original in proposing Jewish emigration to Madagascar. The Polish government had already considered this scheme in respect of their own Jewish population, and in 1937, they sent Michael Lepecki, the Michael Lepecki Expedition, L-E-P-E-C-K-I, to Madagascar, accompanied by Jewish representatives to investigate the problems involved. Michael Lepecki Expedition from Poland to Madagascar, accompanied by Jewish representatives to see if it was possible to put Poland's Jews there. And remember, Poland was where most of the Jews, the Ashkenazi, generated from. The first Nazi proposals for a Madagascar solution were made in association with the Schacht Plan of 1938. On the advice of Goering, Hitler agreed to send the president of the Reichsbank, Dr. Hjalmar Schacht, to London for discussions with Jewish representatives, Lord Bierstadt and Mr. Rubley of New York. C.F. Reitlinger, The Final Solution, London, 1953, page 20. The plan was that German-Jewish assets would be frozen as security for an international loan to finance Jewish emigration to Palestine, and Schacht reported on these negotiations to Hitler at Berchtesgaden on January 2, 1939. The plan, which failed due to British refusal to accept the financial terms, was first put forward on November 12, 1938, at a conference convened by Goering, who revealed that Hitler was already considering the emigration of Jews to a settlement in Madagascar. Ibid, page 121. Later in December, Ribbentrop was told by M. Georges Bonnet, the French Foreign Secretary, that the French government itself was planning the evacuation of 10,000 Jews to Madagascar. Prior to the Schacht Palestine proposals of 1938, which were essentially a protraction of discussions that had begun as early as 1935, numerous attempts had been made to secure Jewish emigration to other European nations, and these efforts culminated in the Evian Conference of July 1938. E-V-I-A-N, the Evian Conference of 1938. However, by 1939, the scheme of Jewish emigration to Madagascar had gained the most favor in German circles. It is true that in London, Helmuth Wohltat of the German Foreign Office discussed limited Jewish immigration to Rhodesia and British Guiana as late as April 1939, but by January 24th, when Goering wrote to Interior Minister Frick ordering the creation of a central emigration office for Jews, and commissioned Heydrich of the Reich Security Head Office to solve the Jewish problems, quote, by means of emigration and evacuation, the Madagascar plan was being studied in earnest. So, Interior Minister Frick creates a central emigration office for Jews and commissions Heydrich of the Reich Security Head Office to say, okay, solve the Jewish problem by emigration and evacuation. Just get them out of here. Not kill them, not exterminate them. Get them out of the country to somewhere else. Talk to these different people and see what can be arranged. By 1939, the consistent efforts of the German government to secure the departure of Jews from the Reich had resulted in the emigration of 400,000 Jews. 400,000 German Jews from a total population of about 600,000, and an additional 480,000 emigrants from Austria and Czechoslovakia, which constituted almost their entire Jewish populations. This was accomplished through offices of Jewish emigration in Berlin, Vienna, and Prague, established by Adolf Eichmann, the head of the Jewish Investigation Office, the Gestapo. So eager were the Germans to secure this emigration that Eichmann even established a training center in Austria where young Jews could learn farming in anticipation of being smuggled illegally to Palestine. Parentheses, Manville and Frankel, SS and Gestapo, page 60. Had Hitler cherished any intention of exterminating the Jews, it is inconceivable that he would have allowed more than 800,000 to leave Reich territory with the bulk of their wealth, much less considered plans for their mass emigration to Palestine or Madagascar. So there's 600,000 Jews, and he lets and encourages 500,000 of them to leave, plus another basically 400,000 from Czechoslovakia and Austria. So remember, Vienna was full of Jews. That's where Hitler learned about Jews. So it doesn't make any sense if you're going to kill them to encourage them to emigrate and actually let them emigrate and actually let them emigrate with their money and their assets. What is more, we shall see that the policy of emigration from Europe was still under consideration well into the war period, notably the Madagascar Plan, which Eichmann discussed in 1940 with French colonial office experts after the defeat of France had made the surrender of the colony a practical proposition. Section 2. German policy toward the Jews after the outbreak of war. With the coming of war, the situation regarding the Jews altered drastically. It is not widely known that World Jewry declared itself to be a belligerent party in the Second World War, and there was therefore ample basis under international law for the Germans to intern the Jewish population as a hostile force. On September 5, 1939, Chaim Weizmann, the principal Zionist leader, had declared war against Germany on behalf of the world's Jews, stating that, quote, the Jews stand by Great Britain and will fight on the side of the democracies. The Jewish Agency is ready to enter into immediate arrangements for utilizing Jewish manpower, technical ability, resources, etc. And that's from the Jewish Chronicle, September 8, 1939. Detention of enemy aliens. All Jews had thus been declared agents willing to prosecute a war against the German Reich, and as a consequence, Himmler and Heydrich were eventually to begin the policy of internment. It is worth noting that the United States and Canada had already interned all Japanese aliens and citizens of Japanese descent in detention camps before the Germans applied the same security measures against the Jews of Europe. Moreover, there had been no such evidence or declaration of disloyalty by these Japanese Americans as had been given by Weizmann. The British, too, during the Boer War, had interned all the women and children of the population, and thousands had died as a result, Yet in no sense could the British be charged with wanting to exterminate the Boers. The detention of Jews in the occupied territories of Europe served two essential purposes from the German viewpoint. The first was to prevent unrest and subversion. Himmler had informed Mussolini on October 11, 1942, that German policy toward the Jews had altered during the wartime entirely for reasons of military security. He complained that thousands of Jews in the occupied regions were conducting partisan warfare, sabotage, and espionage, a view confirmed by official Soviet information given to Raymond Arthur Davis, that no less than 35,000 European Jews were waging partisan war under Tito in Yugoslavia. As a result, Jews were to be transported to restricted areas and detention camps, both in Germany and especially after March 1942, in the Government General of Poland. As the war proceeded, the policy developed of using Jewish detainees for labor in the war effort. The question of labor is fundamental when considering the alleged plan of genocide against the Jews, for on grounds of logic alone, the latter would entail the most senseless waste of manpower, time, and energy while prosecuting a war of survival on two fronts. Certainly after the attack on Russia, the idea of compulsory labor had taken precedence over German plans for Jewish emigration. The protocol of a conversation between Hitler and the Hungarian regent Horthy on April 17, 1943, reveals that the German leader personally requested Horthy to release 100,000 Hungarian Jews for work in the, quote, pursuit plane program of the Luftwaffe at a time when the aerial bombardment of Germany was increasing. Parentheses, Reitlinger, Die Endlösung, The Final Solution, Berlin, 1956, page 478, that Hitler is talking to Horthy and wanting 100,000 Hungarian Jews for the work in the pursuit plane program. Pursuit plane, hyphenated. This took place at a time when, supposedly, the Germans were already seeking to exterminate the Jews, but Hitler's request clearly demonstrates the priority of expanding his labor force. In harmony with this program, concentration camps became, in fact, industrial complexes. At every camp where Jews and other nationalities were detained, there were large industrial plants and factories supplying material for the German war effort. The Buna, B-U-N-A, rubber factory at Bergen-Belsen, for example. Buna and IG Farben industry at Auschwitz, and the electrical firm of Siemens at Ravensbrück. In many cases, special concentration camp money notes were issued as payment for labor, enabling prisoners to buy extra rations from camp shops. The Germans were determined to obtain the maximum economic return from the concentration camp system, an object wholly at variance with any plan to exterminate millions of people in them. It was the function of the SS Economy and Administration Office, headed by Oswald Pohl, P-O-H-L, to see that the concentration camps became major industrial producers. So the Germans weren't trying to kill the Jews. They were using them for work as they're being bombed and the war is on two fronts and increasingly difficult. If they were going to kill them, they would simply round them up and shoot them. Emigration still favored. It is a remarkable fact, however, that well into the war period, the Germans continued to implement the policy of Jewish emigration. The fall of France in 1940 enabled the German government to open serious negotiations with the French for the transfer of European Jews to Madagascar. A memorandum of August 1942 from Luther, Secretary of State in the German Foreign Office, reveals that he had conducted these negotiations between July and December 1940 when they were terminated by the French. A circular from Luther's department dated August 15, 1940, shows that the details of the German plan had been worked out by Eichmann, for it is signed by his assistant, Daneker. Eichmann had in fact been commissioned in August to draw up a detailed Madagascar plan, Eichmann had been commissioned to draw up, and Daneker was employed in research on Madagascar at the French Colonial Office, that's from Reitlinger, The Final Solution, page 77, The proposals of August 15th were that an inter-European bank was to finance the emigration of 4 million Jews throughout a phased program. Luther's 1942 memorandum shows that Heydrich had obtained Himmler's approval of this plan before the end of August and had also submitted it to Göring. It certainly met with Hitler's approval, for as early as June 17th, his interpreter, Schmidt, recalls Hitler observing to Mussolini that, quote, one could found a state of Israel in Madagascar. Hitler said that to Mussolini. That's from Schmidt, Hitler's interpreter, London, 1951, page 178. Although the French terminated the Madagascar negotiations in December 1940, Polyakov, the director of the Center of Jewish Documentation in Paris, admits that the Germans nevertheless pursued the scheme and that Eichmann was still busy with it throughout 1941. Eventually, however, it was rendered impractical by the progress of the war, in particular by the situation after the invasion of Russia, and on February 10, 1942, the Foreign Office was informed that the plan had been temporarily shelved. This ruling, sent to the Foreign Office by Luther's assistant, Rademacher, is of great importance because it demonstrates conclusively that the term final solution, quote-unquote, meant only the emigration of Jews, and also that transportation to the eastern ghettos and concentration camps, such as Auschwitz, constituted nothing but an alternative plan of evacuation. The directive reads, "The war with the Soviet Union has, in the meantime, created the possibility of disposing of other territories for the final solution. In consequence, the Führer has decided that the Jews should be evacuated not to Madagascar, but to the east. Madagascar need no longer, therefore, be considered in connection with a final solution." Reitlinger, Ibid, page 79. The details of this evacuation had been discussed a month earlier at the Wannsee Conference in Berlin, which we shall examine below. Reitlinger and Polyakov both make the entirely unfounded supposition that because the Madagascar plan had been shelved, the Germans must necessarily have been thinking of, quote, extermination, unquote. Only a month later, however, on March 7, 1942, Goebbels wrote a memorandum in favor of the Madagascar plan as a, quote, final solution, unquote, of the Jewish question. That's from Manville and Frankel, Dr. Goebbels, London, 1960, page 165. In the meantime, he approved of the Jews being, quote, concentrated in the east, direct quote from Goebbels. Later, Goebbels' memoranda also stressed deportation to the east, i.e. the government general of Poland, and lay emphasis on the need for compulsory labor there. Once the policy of evacuation of the East had been inaugurated, the use of Jewish labor became a fundamental part of the operation. It is perfectly clear from the foregoing that the term final solution was applied both to Madagascar and to the Eastern territories, and that therefore it meant only the deportation of the Jews. Even as late as May 1944, the Germans were prepared to allow the emigration of 1 million European Jews from Europe. An account of this proposal is given by Alexander Weisberg, a prominent Soviet Jewish scientist deported during the Stalin purges, in his book Die Geschichte von Joel Brand, The History of Joel Brand, Cologne, 1956. Weisberg, who spent the war in Krakow, though he expected the Germans to intern him in a concentration camp, explains that on the personal authorization of Himmler, Eichmann had sent the Budapest Jewish leader Joel Brand to Istanbul with an offer to the Allies to permit the transfer of 1 million European Jews in the midst of the war. If the extermination writers are to be believed, there were scarcely 1 million Jews left by May 1944, says Harwin in parentheses. The Gestapo admitted that the transportation involved would greatly inconvenience the German war effort, but were prepared to allow it in exchange for 10,000 trucks to be used exclusively on the Russian front. Unfortunately, the plan came to nothing. The British concluded that Brand must be a dangerous Nazi agent and immediately imprisoned him in Cairo, while the press denounced the offer as a Nazi trick. Winston Churchill, though orating to the effect that the treatment of the Hungarian Jews was probably, quote, the biggest and most horrible crime ever committed in the whole history of the world, nevertheless told Chaim Weizmann that acceptance of the brand offers was impossible, since it would be a betrayal of his Russian allies. Although the plan was fruitless, it well illustrates that no one allegedly carrying out, quote, thorough extermination would permit the emigration of a million Jews, and it demonstrates, too, the prime importance placed by the Germans on the war effort. 3. Population and emigration. Statistics relating to Jewish populations are not everywhere known in precise detail. Approximations for various countries differing widely, and it is also unknown exactly how many Jews were deported and interned at any one time between the years 1939 and 1945. In general, however, what reliable statistics there are, especially those relating to emigration, are sufficient to show that not a fraction of 6 million Jews could have been exterminated. In the first place, this claim cannot be remotely upheld on examination of the European Jewish population figures. According to Chambers' encyclopedia, the total number of Jews living in pre-war Europe was 6,500,000. Quite clearly, this would mean that almost the entire number were exterminated. But the Basler Nachrichten, a neutral Swiss publication, employing available Jewish statistical data, establishes that between 1933 and 1945, 1.5 million Jews emigrated to Britain, Sweden, Spain, Portugal, Australia, China, India, Palestine, and the U.S. This is confirmed by the Jewish journalist Bruno Blau, who cites the same figure in the New York Jewish newspaper, Aufbau, August 13, 1948. Of these emigrants, approximately 400,000 came from Germany before September 1939. This is acknowledged by the World Jewish Congress in its publication, Unity and Dispersion, page 377, which states that the majority of the German Jews succeeded in leaving Germany before the war broke out. Direct quote from a Jewish publication, the World Jewish Congress, Unity and Dispersion. The majority of the German Jews succeeded in leaving Germany before World War II broke out. In addition to the German Jews, 220,000 of the total 280,000 Austrian Jews had emigrated by September 1939, while from March 1939 onwards, the Institute for Jewish Emigration in Prague had secured the emigration of 260,000 Jews from former Czechoslovakia. In all, only 360,000 Jews remained in Germany, Austria, and Czechoslovakia after September 1939. So there's not even a 500,000 of them left in some of these countries when the war actually starts. From Poland, an estimated 500,000 had emigrated prior to the outbreak of war. These figures mean that the number of Jewish emigrants from other European countries, France, the Netherlands, Italy, the countries of Eastern Europe, etc., was approximately 120,000. This exodus of Jews before and during hostilities therefore reduces the number of Jews in Europe to approximately 5 million. Remember, they said there were 6.5 million and 1.5 million emigrated. In addition to these emigrants, we must also include the number of Jews who fled to the Soviet Union after 1939 and who were later evacuated beyond reach of the German invaders. It will be shown below that the majority of these, about 1.25 million, 1,250,000, were migrants from Poland, so a lot of them are fleeing east to get behind the Soviet armies. But apart from Poland, Reitlinger admits that 300,000 other European Jews slipped into Soviet territory between 1939 and 1941. This brings the total of Jewish emigrants to the Soviet Union to about 1,550,000. In Collier's magazine, June 9, 1945, Freiling Foster, writing of the Jews in Russia, explained that, quote, 2,200,000 have migrated to the Soviet Union since 1939 to escape from the Nazis. But our lower estimate is probably more accurate, over 1.5 million fled east. Jewish migration to the Soviet Union, therefore, reduces the number of Jews within the sphere of German occupation to around 3.5 million, approximately 3,450,000. So, roughly equal, about 1.5 million fled to other countries and 1.5 million plus fled to Russia. So, get rid of 3 out of 6.5, leaving about 3.5, a little under 3.5, 3,450,000, they're estimating, that even could have been killed. From these should be deducted those Jews living in neutral European countries who escaped the consequences of the war. According to the 1942 World Almanac, the number of Jews living in Gibraltar, Britain, Portugal, Spain, Sweden, Switzerland, Ireland, and Turkey was 413,128. And that leads to the next subtitle, 3 million Jews in Europe. So, basically, a figure, consequently, of around 3 million Jews in German-occupied Europe is as accurate as the available emigration statistics will allow. Approximately the same number, however, can be deduced in another way if we examine statistics for the Jewish populations remaining in countries occupied by the Reich. More than half of those Jews who migrated to the Soviet Union after 1939 came from Poland. It is frequently claimed that the war with Poland added some 3 million Jews to the German sphere of influence, and that almost the whole of this Polish Jewish population was, quote, exterminated. This is a major factual error. The 1931 Jewish population census for Poland put the number of Jews at 2,732,600. That's from Reitlinger, Die Endlösung, The Final Solution, page 36. Reitlinger states that at least 1,170,000 of these were in the Russian zone occupied in the autumn of 1939, about 1 million of whom were evacuated to the Urals in South Siberia after the German invasion of June 1941, Ibid, page 50. As described above, an estimated 500,000 Jews had emigrated from Poland prior to the war. Moreover, the journalist Raymond Arthur Davis, who spent the war in the Soviet Union, observed that approximately 250,000 had already fled from German-occupied Poland to Russia between 1939 and 1941 and were to be encountered in every Soviet province. Parentheses, Odyssey Through Hell, New York, 1946. Subtracting these figures from the population of 2,732,600, therefore, and allowing for the normal population increase, no more than 1,100,000 Polish Jews could have been under German rule at the end of 1939. 1.1 million, after all is said and done, would have been in Poland under German rule. And in parentheses for that, he has Gutachten des Instituts für Zeitgeschichte, Munich, 1956, page 80. To this number, we may add the 360,000 Jews remaining in Germany, Austria, and former Czechoslovakia, Bohemia, Moravia, and Slovakia. After the extensive emigration from those countries prior to the war described above, of the 320,000 French Jews, the public prosecutor representing that part of the indictment relating to France at the Nuremberg trials stated that 120,000 Jews were deported, though. Reitlinger estimates only about 50,000. Thus, the total number of Jews under Nazi rule remains below 2 million. I'll repeat that. The total number of Jews under Nazi rule remains below 2 million. Deportations from the Scandinavian countries were few, and from Bulgaria, none at all. When the Jewish populations of Holland, 140,000, Belgium, 40,000, Italy, 50,000, Yugoslavia, 55,000, Hungary, 380,000, and Romania, 725,000 are included, the figure does not much exceed 3 million. This excess is due to the fact that the latter figures are pre-war estimates unaffected by emigration, which from these countries accounted for about 120,000, see above. This cross-checking, therefore, confirms the estimate of approximately 3 million European Jews under German occupation. And then they're going to turn around and claim that 6 million were murdered. Russian Jews evacuated. The precise figures concerning Russian Jews are unknown and have therefore been the subject of extreme exaggeration. The Jewish statistician Jacob Lisinski states that in 1939 there were 2,100,000 Jews living in future German-occupied Russia, i.e. Western Russia. In addition, some 260,000 lived in the Baltic states of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. According to Louis Levine, president of the American Jewish Council for Russian Relief, who made a post-war tour of the Soviet Union and submitted a report on the status of Jews there, the majority of these numbers were evacuated east after the German armies launched their invasion. In Chicago on October 30, 1946, he declared that, quote, "At the outset of the war, Jews were among the first evacuated from the western regions threatened by the Hitlerite invaders and shipped to safety east of the Urals. 2 million Jews were thus saved." This high number is confirmed by the Jewish journalist David Bergelson, who wrote in the Moscow Yiddish paper, Anikite, December 5, 1942, that, quote, "Thanks to the evacuation, the majority, 80%, of the Jews in the Ukraine, White Russia, Lithuania, and Latvia before the arrival of the Germans were rescued." So 80% of them were gotten out. Reitlinger agrees with the Jewish authority Joseph Schechtman, who admits that huge numbers were evacuated, though he estimates a slightly higher number of Russian and Baltic Jews left under German occupation, between 650,000 and 850,000. Reitlinger, The Final Solution, page 499. In respect of these Soviet Jews remaining in German territories, it will be proved later that in the war in Russia, no more than 100,000 persons were killed by the German action groups as partisans and Bolshevik commissars, not all of whom were Jews. By contrast, the partisans themselves claimed to have murdered five times that number of German troops. "6 million untrue," according to Neutral Swiss. It is clear, therefore, that the Germans could not possibly have gained control over or exterminated anything like 6 million Jews. Excluding the Soviet Union, the number of Jews in Nazi-occupied Europe after emigration was scarcely more than 3 million, by no means all of whom were interned. To approach the extermination of even half of 6 million would have meant the liquidation of every Jew living in Europe. And yet it is known that large numbers of Jews were alive in Europe after 1945. Philip Friedman in Their Brother's Keepers, New York 1957, page 13, states that, quote, "at least 1 million Jews survived in the very crucible of Nazi hell," unquote. While the official figure of the Jewish Joint Distribution Committee is 1,559,600. Thus, even if one accepts the latter estimate, the number of possible wartime Jewish deaths could not have exceeded a limit of 1.5 million, because the Jews themselves were saying, oh, 1.6 million were left after the war, and there couldn't have been more than 3 million, leaving, if they were killed, there could have only been 1.4, even in theory, and of course there weren't that. So again, thus, even if one accepts the latter estimate, the number of possible wartime Jewish deaths could not have exceeded a limit of 1.5 million. Precisely this conclusion was reached by the reputable journal Basler Nachrichten. Nachrichten is the German term for news. Basler means the Basler, Basel, the town, newspaper. Basler News of Neutral Switzerland, that no more than 1.5 million Jews could have been killed. In an article entitled, Wie hoch ist der Zahl der jüdischen Opfer? How high is the number of Jewish victims? June 13, 1946, it explained that purely on the basis of the population and emigration figures described above, a maximum of only 1.5 million Jews could be numbered as casualties. Later on, however, it will be demonstrated conclusively that the number was actually far less. For the Basler Nachrichten, accepted the Joint Distribution Committee's figure of 1,559,600 survivors after the war, but we shall show that the number of claims for compensation by Jewish survivors is more than double that figure. This information was not available to the Swiss in 1946. Impossible birth rate. Indisputable evidence is also provided by the post-war world Jewish population statistics. The World Almanac of 1938 gives the number of Jews in the world as 16,588,259. But after the war, the New York Times, February 22, 1948, places the number of Jews in the world at a minimum of 15,600,000 and a maximum of 18,700,000. Quite obviously, these figures make it impossible for the number of Jewish wartime casualties to be measured in anything but thousands. $15.5 million in 1938 minus the alleged $6 million leaves $9 million. The New York Times figures would mean, therefore, that the world's Jews produced 7 million births, almost doubling their numbers, in the space of 10 years. This is patently ridiculous. It would appear, therefore, that the great majority of the missing 6 million were in fact emigrants. Emigrants to European countries, to the Soviet Union, and the U.S. before, during, and after the war. And emigrants also in vast numbers to Palestine, during and especially at the end of the war. After 1945, boatloads of these Jewish survivors entered Palestine illegally from Europe, causing considerable embarrassment to the British government at the time. Indeed, so great were the numbers that the HM Stationery Office, publication number 190, November 5, 1946, described them as, quote, almost amounting to a second exodus, that is, the Jews' so-called supposed departure from Egypt. It was these emigrants to all parts of the world who had swollen the world Jewish population to between 15 and 18 millions by 1948, and probably the greatest part of them were emigrants to the U.S. who entered in violation of the quota laws. On August 16, 1963, David Ben-Gurion, president of Israel, stated that although the official Jewish population of America was said to be 5,600,000, quote, the total number would not be estimated too high at 9 million. So Jews engaged in little census tricks so they weren't even counted in the U.S., so they could hide their true numbers of their population. But here's one admitting, David Ben-Gurion, president of Israel, that the actual population would not be estimated too high at 9 million. The source for that is Deutsche Wochenzeitung, German weekly paper, November 23, 1963. The reason for this high figure is underlined by Albert Meisel in his article, Our Newest Americans, Reader's Digest, January 1957, for he reveals that, quote, soon after World War II, by presidential decree, 90% of all quota visas for Central and Eastern Europe were issued to the uprooted. Reprinted on this page is just one extract from hundreds that regularly appear in the obituary columns of Aufbau, the Jewish American weekly published in New York, June 16, 1972. It shows how Jewish emigrants to the U.S. subsequently changed their names. Their former names, when in Europe, appear in brackets. For example, as below, Arthur Kingsley, formerly Dr. Königsberger of Frankfurt. Could it be that some or all of these people whose names are deceased were included in the missing 6 million of Europe? And that ends the third section. We're going to leave it there, and we'll pick it up next time with the fourth. Thanks for being with me today. I'm Alex Lender. I've been reading to you from Richard Harwood's Did 6 Million Really Die? You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com and later permanently at alexlinder.com. I'll be back with you again for more real soon.